Welcome to the Brand the Interpreter podcast. I am your host, Mireya Perez, and this platform is dedicated to sharing the stories of language professionals, that is, the interpreters and translators from around the world. This show aims to highlight not just the profession, but mainly the people behind the amazing work. These are your stories about our profession, and this is the Brand the Interpreter podcast. Welcome to Brand the Interpreter, the podcast where I share your stories about the profession of interpreting and translation through the captivating stories of experts in the field. I'm your host, Mireya Perez, and in each episode, we dive deep into the experiences, challenges, and triumphs of our guest speakers who bridge linguistic and cultural gaps on a daily basis. Thank you for joining me today. Today's episode brings us Hemi Parayani, who grew up in Tehran, Iran, speaking both Armenian and Farsi, and later picking up the English language in school. Growing up, Hemi knew she aspired to be a connector and a mediator to solve problems. She worked in three countries and industries in Iran, Austria, and the US with large corporations, banking, higher education, and the World Relief Agency in Vienna. Through these experiences, she learned customer service, communication, and leadership skills, helping her to become, as she says, a well-rounded interpreter. She has been interpreting for over 30 years, and in 2017, becoming a full-time remote interpreter. Today, she joins the Brand the Interpreter podcast with a call to action. So, without further ado, please welcome Hemi Parayani to the show. Hemi, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here today.
Sure, my pleasure. Thank you.
Share with us where you grew up and what a fond childhood memory is of yours.
Well, yeah, I'm of course Armenian from Iran, so I'm an Armenian and Farsi interpreter. My nationality is Armenian, and I was born and raised in Tehran, Iran. My childhood memories basically is embedded with my cousins, spending with friends. But one thing that helps me to know where I am now professionally is this memory of having coordinating and orchestrating a summer or a concert. So I was about 12, 13, and we were living in a neighborhood that they had children my age, maybe 2 years older and or younger. And I was leading a group of dancers, doing theater, and also choir. I learned that from my school, so I brought it back to my neighborhood. And it was such a challenging time because some children were 9, 10 years old. They would, summertime, they go swimming and they would sleep or take a nap. And I would go after them, knock the door. Hey, we have rehearsal. You have to practice. And it was so difficult to gather everybody in one place. We were practicing. Boys would just on their bikes and running away. So I had to go after them. So it took, now I realized such a leadership and project management requirements. And we did it old-fashioned way. And it was so much fun, lots of work, lots of burden on me because I was feeling responsible. And my mom would say, why are you sweating on this? This is just supposed to be fun. You're not selling. I said, yes, we are selling tickets for 5 cents. It's a business. So we and neighborhood parents were so supportive, and they came to our concert. And one, it was so much fun. The dance, the choir, everybody was from different culture, and we had imagined singing one song in different accents. Yeah. It was wonderful, and I never forget when it was the time for break. Like we had concession table, and all these children jumped and grabbed chips or knickknacks, and I would say, that's for our customers.
So you had an entrepreneurial spirit from a very young age, it sounds like, right? Were you ever considering growing up that you would be involved in the performing arts world, maybe as you got older? Was that, what did you aspire to be when you grew up?
I really liked dancing. And in fact, I started my dancing class, so-called, with a very professional and prestigious studio, but it was my late teens. But still, I just acquired what I really, really dreamed of. The setting, the environment, the dressing room, chit-chatting with the girls before we go to the studio, the discipline and getting ready and getting this vibe about getting on stage. I experienced it. But unfortunately, it was short-lived because then the revolution, Islamic revolution started and we had to just scatter and the school closed.
Wow. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit further about your childhood growing up in Iran. Right now, I'm interested in knowing a little bit more about your language combination. So you speak Armenian and Farsi. Were these two languages spoken in the home by your parents? Or talk to us a little bit about that dynamic. How did that look like for you growing up?
Mm-hmm. Well, at the time, we didn't have access to the world. We thought everybody lives this way. Everybody is bilingual or trilingual. We took it as granted. I was Armenian. So at home, we were speaking Armenian with family, relatives. But outside, we would, outside going shopping or having Persian friends, we would speak Farsi. And school I went, it was a private school that they taught both languages. So we were learning the subjects in Armenian and Farsi. So, for example, the essays in Armenian, essays in Farsi, grammar, history. It was, in a way, it shaped our personalities. So we became more adaptable to cultures, to people's mindset, and made us more inclusive and accepting others. That's how I began my journey of languages, and it became very easy to transfer.
Transfer both languages. Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier that the Islamic Revolution had started right around what age for you? Do you recall?
Yes, I was 19 years old.
And share with us, if you can, what that meant for you as a unit, as a family. What was that experience like in terms of you having to move elsewhere, being relocated? What was that like for you?
When revolution started, we were just thinking it, oh, it's going to pass. It's one of those political things we see on news. But then it just stayed. And we had to, again, adapt and adjust. And it was shocking. It was shocking for all of us. And that's why sometimes I believe I'm still 19. Because I was frozen, in a way. Right. Personality-wise, emotionally, spiritually. And when I started feeling the pain was when I saw my friends were leaving. Mm-hmm. They were leaving the country. They were going abroad. And it was difficult. We were having parties, dances, music, food, and everything. Now we can have that. If we go in a house and having a party, we have to be hush, hush, quiet. And shut the curtains and then stay until next morning because it was a martial law and we weren't able to leave. So it was very difficult. But, you know, being young, you take everything easy. Mm-hmm. You cannot take everything fun. Well, that's a change. But the pain for me was basically when I was away from my relatives and my friends. So that made me a different person.
Mm. Eventually, you did end up relocating and then picking up the English language. Talk to us about that moment in time and what transitioned or what transpired in order for you to begin learning a third language.
Mm-hmm. Well, English language we were taught at school, because when we went to kindergarten, they ask you, do you want to pursue English or you want to pursue French? I chose English. So I learned English ever since I was in kindergarten. But as for and the grammar and then the essays, writing, but not as intense as we teach in schools in the U.S. or other English-speaking countries. However, I personally liked the language very much. So I went to a special private institute of languages, foreign languages, and I picked up English. So after school, I would just take the bus and go to, this was when I was 16, 17. And I would have conversation partners from Australia when they were visiting in Iran or United Kingdom. And I would just pay, and I just invested it for the language, because in school they teach you the basics. And then, of course, I got very lucky. One of my friends who moved to New York, she said, hey, I have a job that I think you'll do better than I do. I said, how come? She says, your English is better than me. This is a British company. And I started my first job with a British civil engineering company. And that's how I learned management, administrative aspect of my role. And, of course, diplomacy, and about how to navigate through cultures, through business, through how to correct your mistakes and take accountability for your mistakes. And that's how I learned about business life and basically culture. Because this was in an era that war and revolution mixed up. And I was working as a young professional, and I had to somehow keep the balance, mm-hmm. To make sure everybody, there's a peace.
Yeah.
So interpreting correctly and trying to be comfortable with each parties. So that was something that there was no coach, there was no training at the time. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you become a self-taught professional. And I think I was a self-taught professional.
Yeah. And then out of all topics, civil engineering, which is, you know, it's not just an easy topic, mm-hmm. or terminology, right? It's not your layman terms, your basic stuff. Like this is, these are, when it comes to high register, that would be a great example of, mm-hmm. or rather, mm-hmm. excuse me, technical terminology. That'd be a great example of it, right?
Yes.
The civil engineering. Were you working abroad?
No, I was in Tehran, and this company had an office in Tehran. Oh. And they were based in London and Reading, England.
Eventually, you made your way into something else, though, however, right, where you yes. had more hands-on on this notion of translation, more so, right? Talk to us about how that transpired and what that entailed.
Yes. At the time when I was working for the company, as a secretary and administrative, wearing different types of hats, even ordering tea and coffee for the boss, I had to go through channels, interpret. And so I didn't feel that I am doing this. Like I said, we took it as granted. And for translation part of it, like you said, it was a high register, very difficult terminology. How do I know, 20-year-old, and in the midst of a revolution and war, about power stations, about water dams, about huge pipes and all this difficult engineering setup. So we had translation, a professional translator in our office who would translate the material from Farsi to English, and from English to Farsi. So we were communicating with Water District in Tehran, because this project was coming from government and they were accepting. This project was going on for a long, long time. It wasn't a new project. And unfortunately, because of the war and revolution, British had to leave and subcontractors left. Therefore, it was unfinished on their part. But my role was to look at the translation, translating from one language to other. If it didn't make sense line by line, I would ask the translator and we would put our heads together to see how we go about it. If there was terminology we were kind of confused, we would go to engineers who were English speakers or Farsi speakers. They would open it to us. They would make it sense so we could construct the sentences correctly, and I would type and he would edit, and we would send it up, off to whoever the receiver was.
Wow, that's, I mean, in terms of just the conversation about being self-taught, it's like a lot of the things that you're taught in formal studies, whether it's for translation or interpreting, you're seeing it, that you were already applying it, right? You didn't even, I'm sure by then, didn't even realize that you were actually doing that. But you did mention that you had a professional translator on site. So you understood that this was a profession by then? Am I correct in that? Did you understand that this?
Yes. Oh, yes. He went to school for it, and he got higher level education for translation. Yes, they had translators in Iran, and they had school for translation and interpreting, because movies from Hollywood come, and it's the interpreters and translators who translate the language and they put a voice over. That's what it's called, I believe, voiceover.
Voiceovers, yeah. Eventually, you made your way to the States and just made your way into freelance interpreting, right? Talk to us about that experience and what brought you to the States first and foremost, and then, of course, how you got started as a freelance interpreter for your specific language combination. Mm-hmm.
Well, I came to United States because I love the country, and I came in a goal to pursue my education, and I got married in California.
Oh, really?
And, yes.
To a Californian? You got married to a Californian? Someone that lived here in California?
He was an immigrant from, just like me, from Tehran, Iran. But he was here in California. Yes. And then I had my child, and how this, I started a work that it was close to what I studied in Tehran, administrative. That was my job in a credit department. I really, really loved my job. Actually, I was sharing with my daughter that how much success I had with that business. I was a credit specialist, and then I got promoted in no time. And at the time, I went to Fullerton College to study philosophy and Apple computers, which was very frustrating, very difficult. But I was young and up. I had this passion for learning. So you become a little bit ambitious. So new country, new school, it's cool. So I, because of it, I just started to be successful at work. But when I came to Oregon, I started a business completely different to what I used to do. It was a deli, restaurant, 7-Eleven business. In downtime, I would do interpreting. There was this company that just started in Portland, in her basement, actually. It was an agency in her basement. So I introduced myself, and she said, yeah, I'll take Farsi and Armenian interpreters. So at the time, I would go to OHSU, Oregon Health and Science University, for interpreting. And then slowly went to municipal courts and the schools and the hospitals, clinics, you name it, all the bundle. And at the time, I didn't do much translating, but interpreting. But this was on site. It was my side hustle, in a way. it was not my profession. I was an entrepreneur in business, or if I were working in a job, at a job, for example, I worked for a university, I worked for a bank, I worked for a mortgage company. All these roles that I had, actually, Miraya, it helped me to be a well-rounded interpreter, because you interpret for insurance, you interpret for banks, you interpret for school. And all these experiences I captured, at the time I thought, oh, they are dead-end roles. I'm not going to get a career off of this. But now I think that these experiences were school for me.
Wow, yeah.
It helped me in customer service, in patience, in having compassion towards others, and bringing what I learned to calling, like when I am on the call, the call etiquette. Call has etiquette, the voice variation, the calmness, and mirroring your sound with the person's talking. And all these variations helped me to be more patient and deliver the way I am. I believe ethically I deliver right. And and then after 2017, I said, hey, why don't I just take this as a full time? And this was about the time that interpreting was booming. And I wasn't aware of it, that it's starting to skyrocket, and it becomes $1 billion business now. And I started doing it full time. So I made myself available. I signed up with different agencies. I signed up with Oregon Judicial Court. And as ambitious and competent I am not greedy, because I want to keep the balance between job, self-care, and business. So therefore, I am happy where I am. However, I like to, of course, develop, learn, and cast my net and expand my territory. And that's always in my mind. But but being aggressive about it, no, I'm just more lean back.
Yeah, you captured a few things that I do want to circle back to later on in our conversation about how you approach your freelance work. But for now, I'd like to talk a little bit about what you saw when you moved to Portland, Oregon, when it came to the Farsi or Armenian communities out in Portland, Oregon, and what you saw in terms of, you know, just how you approach these encounters. Because I feel that sometimes when we are working with our language pairs, we are so caught up in that world that we tend to obviously, well, not obviously, but I think unintentionally forget that not all cultures are working in the same way, or not our cultures are approached in the same way. We see this highlighted in interpreting studies, or more so with interpreting training, right? Mm-hmm. And where they are always sharing how we have to be very aware of the different cultures that we are teaching interpreting to, because not everything in our ethical code of ethics is black and white with all cultures that it's going to transfer over. Mm-hmm. And I had a gentleman on the show with an indigenous language in the past, who did talk about, you know, just a little bit how different when they are working with that community it is, because they very much rely on you as almost like the advocate. And it's almost like expected for, you know, someone from that culture to sort of step in and assist. So this whole, like, I am your interpreter only is a little bit frowned upon in the community, you know? So I'm just curious to know what your experience was working with these particular communities. What were you seeing were some of their challenges? And then, of course, guide us through how different it is for a Farsi interpreter when you are in the role of the interpreter.
Very good question, Maria. For my language pair, Armenian and Farsi, and to English. So it's not a pair. So they are not indigenous languages. The languages that have literacy and they have history, they are one language that I interpret, which it is indigenous, is a Dari language, which is Afghan speaking. Only Afghan speaking speakers. You hardly can find anybody from Iran speaking Dari. They do speak Farsi. So Dari and Farsi, very similar. It's just a dialect. It's just the accent. And if a Dari speaker is went to school, even up to eighth grade, speaking Farsi is no problem. I mean, we get each other. But however, if they don't have literacy, it becomes different because they're using the local vocabulary and you have to just ask for clarifying questions. Or I have to do some research and go to other Afghan speakers and ask them, okay, what does that mean? For example, how do you say certain things, or even the dates were different. The 12 months of the year, they have it different. So I have to do my research to write it down. But if they have education a little bit, it's very easy to communicate in Farsi language. So now for their indigenous language, you're absolutely right. They think you are their representative. And it's very difficult to say, hey, I'm only here to interpret for you. It's like, it's, they feel like, oh, you're aloof, distant, you're mean. So I believe we should adjust ourselves because especially the customers or the LEP, indigenous languages from Afghanistan, I do feel compassionate about them. I know what they went through. I mean, most of us know what they went through. They are relocated with nothingness and they have to adjust. For example, I was interpreting for a pregnant woman who was in a hotel and she was there for a week. She says, I can't eat the food. I don't even know what is it on the tray. I haven't been eating. So, and then, and I'm saying, what is it on the tray? This is on telephone. They say macaroni, cheese, this sandwich, that sandwich, it's a ham sandwich. I said, well, they don't eat ham. They don't eat pork. And then I had to clarify with this pregnant lady. She says, no, I don't eat pork. And that's why I'm not eating because I'm not trusting what is on my plate. So I had to play the advocacy role and say, okay, she's pregnant. She needs nutrition. And I'm asking her, if it were your country, what would you eat? What would you like? So I had to make a little menu for her so she'll get her nutrition. Same with other children. Children were unaware. But then after a month or two, you see them, they're eating pizza. They like it. And right. Playing a role of advocacy, it's humane. It's right. It's the right thing to do. Especially people who cannot articulate themselves, and you become their voice, and we are people's voice in a way. So I believe it is harder, it is more difficult because it's not only the transfer or rendering the information, it's lots of thinking and lots of putting ourselves in their shoes. And for example, I would just say, hey, can you just bring some rice? Maybe they can substitute with a little bit of chicken and a little bit of salad to make it more whole, more balanced. So which it worked both ways. It was a win-win situation.
Yeah. By the way, the episode for those listeners that are always seeking to go back to whatever episode I'd mentioned, I'll make sure to put it in the episode notes, but it is Indigenous Interpreting with Eulogio Espinosa. And he is one of the guests that had mentioned, you know, the intricacies of having to work with these specific communities. Now, going back to you, Hemi, the question with regards to the these pockets of communities for Armenian and Farsi languages. Was it different from California to Portland? Did you see more? Did you see less? And yes. What were those needs that you were identifying?
Yes, that's exactly the question I have to answer. Yes, I remember. Actually, to be honest with you, Armenians who come from different parts of the world because of diaspora, they adopt different culture. So if I'm speaking from with an Armenian from Armenia, so that's a different type of culture I have to adopt. They use some Russian words and I go, oh, here you use the Russian word. I don't know Russian. I'm from Iran. So they have to explain. Or, for example, you kind of get their attitude. The attitude is different because the way we live in different environment, geographical and socioeconomical condition, we change. And we just being aware of it, being educated about it, it's easy to adapt. Say, okay, so this person, I know it's aggressive, so I have to just kind of manage the call. I'm not saying Armenians from Armenia are aggressive, but I mean, if in case they were, mm-hmm. oh, I want the answer right now. I'm not convinced. So you play a role of advocacy. Okay, here's the thing. May I explain this to your client? And then this is the process in this country. You have to do 1, 2, 3 ABC to get there. Mm-hmm. So, or if an Armenian from Beirut or a different Western countries, so I have to adapt my accent or somehow understand their accent in order to communicate. And Armenians from Iran, very easy because they use Farsi. I know Farsi. So I don't say, hey, what does that mean? It is very, for me, if I were to say, hey, which cause you get, you go, oh, perfect, showtime. this is easy. For me, Armenians from Armenia, very easy. It's very easy, it's like talking to your neighbor. And Armenians from Armenia is easy too. It's Eastern Armenian. Mm. However, there's a little bit of bump here and there, which clarifying questions help both sides. They ask me, what do you mean by that? So I have to clarify. And for Farsi speakers from Iran, very easy. I have no problem. Farsi speakers from Afghanistan, however, if, like I said, they do have the education, it becomes easy. And there are times that they go, oh, I want Dari speaker interpreter. I don't want her. I don't understand. She's from Iran. And doctor says, okay, don't you speak Dari? I say, doctor, allow me to explain. This is the same language. There is an accent. It's like you go to Ireland. If somebody speaks with heavy Irish accent, you will understand. He says, yeah, okay, then let's do it. And then I tell them, you know, lady or you, sir, I speak with, I work with Afghan community. Allow me to proceed. If you're not happy, then I'll get off the phone or I just leave you alone. And 100 out of 100% works.
Yeah. Did you see a big difference with the pockets of community of this community between the two states? Did you see a difference?
Yes.
More or less?
I can't really it wouldn't be, the comparison would be skewed because I moved to Oregon 34 years ago. So at the time in California, they did have interpreters for court perhaps, mm. but not as heavy because we didn't have as much immigrants mm-hmm. at the time. So, so I can't really tell, but right now, the industry has changed. People are changed. And communities are changed, requirements. You're in education interpreting, you know. And they did, back in the day, they didn't have IEPs. They didn't have evaluations that they perform now with softwares. So, as far as population, when I first came to Oregon, we didn't have much Persian speakers. and the only Persians were college students. Actually, I wanted to open a big international store, and somebody told me, why are you doing that? Don't invest it. These kids are school kids. They don't have money to purchase, and they don't have parents here to cook. So why do you want to open a market, food market? And I said, okay, then, yeah. But now their parents came. Their parents' parents came.
Oh no. Missed opportunity.
It's still a work in progress. It's evolving.
Yes, absolutely. I think usually that's the way it works, right? Whatever is happening or is going on in the environment may take or be an element of how communities are sort of shifting, right, in different areas and different places. So I could only imagine. Yeah, you've seen some changes. Do you tend to work more over the phone interpreting or video remote interpreting, or what is your experience currently as a full time interpreter? What are you seeing mostly that you're getting? The Orange County Department of Education is proud to host their 7th annual Interpreters and Translators Conference, September 29th and 30th, at the Hilton Orange County Costa Mesa in Costa Mesa, California. This conference promotes the incredible work of interpreters and translators, bilingual persons, and staff tasked with providing language access in schools and in the community. Know your path. Each step matters to ensure language access is this year's theme and main focus. Conference sessions and engagements will respond to the core belief that language access is a foundational part of an inclusive and culturally responsive educational ecosystem. Participants will delve into unique opportunities to acquire and refine their skills, learn tips and strategies to enhance their professional practices, keep up to date with the latest trends, laws, and expectations, and explore the use of diverse platforms and tools that can streamline their language service efforts. Language access is a priority in public education, and as interpreters and translators working in the K-12 system are more visible than ever, becoming a substantial part of every educational encounter, it is imperative to professionalize the field through continuous improvement, training, growth, and networking. The Orange County Department of Education Language Services team is at the forefront of providing these professional learning opportunities and experiences for its interpreters, translators, bilingual staff, school administrators, and community liaisons, and is committed to communicating across cultures to provide meaningful language access to their families, students, and the communities they serve. Join them this fall at the 2023 Interpreters and Translators Conference to continue your professional learning and networking. Registration is now open, so head on over to the episode notes to find out more about the Interpreters and Translators Conference hosted by the Orange County Department of Education's Language Services Division, taking place September 29th and 30th. Hope to see you there.
Mostly I work virtual. However, it's my preference by choice because I don't have to drive.
Yeah.
Yeah. And because in the past I did lots of driving. I went to Vancouver, Washington, back to Southeast Portland, and go to Northeast Portland, back to Southwest. So zigzagging all over the town. And, you know, these two states, as you know, now the climate is changing, but it's a heavy raining states. So I don't want to total a car again. So I really appreciate it. But there are times that I really like this human connection, like human connection in person. So I take the jobs. And then if they are calling me and saying, hey, Emmy, they are requiring you. So I don't mind the drive. I go. If you want me, I'll go wherever you want me to go.
Yeah, I think it's beautiful now that, you know, there's the opportunity to choose as language professionals to be able to choose the modality in which we'd like to work. So, and the beauty of being able to choose all of the above, right? If we so wish to in person, over the phone, video remote, and that the agencies have the ability to provide this as an option. I think that's it. Just it's a way of seeing how we're able to do our job, still do it well, but have options as to how we're going to do it. I think that's, you know, that's one of the great things, especially nowadays. Yes. Just reading an article about that on one of the magazines. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about how the option to provide remote interpreting services just took this huge shift and stayed that way because it existed. It's always existed, right? Like for ASL interpreters, mm-hmm. the remote interpreting component, and over the phone for, you know, spoken languages has existed. But it's just what a huge uptake it took, and that it stayed that way for the most part, you know, after the pandemic. I think it just comes to show how we're able to provide our services in different modalities, which is
yes. Great. You know, just to interject, if I may, when I was not working, I was between jobs. Like I said, I was taking interpreting assignments here and there. And I was doing lots of networking because at the time buzz was networking. You just print your business card and wherever you go, here, hello, my name is Sammy. This is my business card. This is what I do. And my daughter was keep telling me, Mom, networking is not working. I said, no, you have to get social. You have to go. And she did her part, whatever her industry or path was, and I did mine. And to be honest, I have seen more success with Zoom and virtual. I am connecting with people all over the world. Where local, we were limited, and they don't, because everybody is after getting a job or getting a lead. So we were focused on ourselves, but now it's more broad, and I really appreciate the opportunity of having virtual communication. This is working.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. It's like the global aspect has mm-hmm. has changed the game completely. I agree. And the networking, of course, is that the opportunity to expand beyond our own borders or boundaries is just, it's only expanded opportunities, which is actually a great segue to the next topic I wanted to talk about, which had to do with the networking component of the work. When we move to different areas, I can't tell you how many individuals have connected with me to just get ideas as to where they can begin to connect with other professionals because they have moved into a different state and don't know where to start. So did you find that it was easy to, you sort of gave us an idea right now, but did you find it easy to connect with other Armenian or Farsi interpreters in Portland, Oregon? Or what was that like for you?
No connection, actually. I think that's what we're lacking all over. I always visualize this, that we need a hub in each city. You know how we have career coaching, we have business coaching. We do need interpreter coaches. Yes, we do connect with webinars and we learn and we get a certificate. That's perfect. Nothing is wrong. But if something comes up and we need help that moment, for example, there is this contract, this portion, I don't get it. Should I sign it or not? Mm. Well, okay, you might have a lawyer and call your lawyer and run it by him or her, but there are not too many people have a lawyer, right? Mm-hmm. So we need a hub with professionals who support interpreters. At the times, they are either grieving, they have vicarious trauma, they need coaches to guide them. We do have societies we can turn to, but we need specific hub or an office in each city. Doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be hiring special somebody like you who's professional and cares for the profession. You could be a member, either virtual or in person. But we do need that. That's lacking. And, you know, we have to go through research, find somebody and ask one simple question. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you had this office, you would just run it by them, get a validation or your questions answered.
Yeah, and I think representation of, you know, the different pockets of languages is absolutely helpful because, like you said, there's the language piece is one thing, but then combining language with the profession, I agree, is a whole other thing, right? Because now you have very specific examples or situations that you want to share with one another and that only you would understand. I have family members that speak my language combinations, but when I bring in the aspect of interpreting specifically, right, mm-hmm. they don't know anything mm-hmm. about that, and so they can't relate or you know mm-hmm. be able to provide advice or examples or things like yes. that because two completely separate things.
Yeah. And you know it's not healthy because we keep it inside until one day we get some clarification or some closure. Whereas if we had some yes, you can turn to colleagues here and there if you know. That's fine. But I'm talking about an office or a hub. For example, I say, hey, I like to connect with a Dari speaker from Afghanistan, interpreter, to ask certain questions, to ask cultural questions or work-related. So I don't have that. I have to research and find one. Mm. And I'm not sure if they are credentialed or if they are really there following the rules. So I want to make sure I'm speaking with somebody who was somehow validated by the office, or I call it hub. I don't know if it's the right the terminology for it. But I think we mostly work in silos and we need that support system.
No, I like that. I think that I think hub really does, at least for me that I'm a visual learner, gives me that visual of what we're really referring to when we talk about these specific, just pockets of support very specific to the mm-hmm. languages and the industry. I think that, mm-hmm. For instance, we see it in with the ATA, the mm-hmm. ATA, the American Translators Association, does offer for its members. I believe you have to be a member, but I'm not sure about that. You know, one would have to do their due diligence to make sure that this is in fact the case. So don't quote me on this, but I believe that you have to be a member and be able to be a part of the specific language mm-hmm. groups mm-hmm. under mm-hmm. the ATA.
Yes,
right?
You need to be a member, yes.
Yeah, so I don't know if, you know, if it's all languages or if they need people to begin, you know, the hub or the club or the, you know, that mm-hmm. specific division, mm-hmm. language division under ATA. But of course, like you say, that's a virtual thing because they can be connected from anywhere. And then during the conference, you know, you all mm-hmm. gather and take part in different discussions. Whereas to hear what we're looking for is something on site, you know, something in person that maybe you could have, monthly, bi-monthly meetings, right? Mm-hmm. Where you all connect mm-hmm. and be able mm-hmm. to share things like that.
Yes.
It's important. Yes. Yeah, it definitely is important. Especially I feel like, when you're having maybe conversations about resources in particular, I'm thinking about currently a situation, different languages and different area, but with refugee situations out in San Diego when that was happening. And I know that, you know, it was the Arabic speaking community that was getting together, not necessarily with interpreters or trained interpreters, but there were Arabic speakers and they were just in dire need of more interpreters because of what was happening and mm-hmm. all the situations. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like they potentially that group, because it's usually nonprofit organizations that are putting together the support services and being able to tap into those resources. Imagine what it would be like if they knew that there was a local hub, mm-hmm, right, of mm-hmm, interpreters mm-hmm, that they could mm-hmm. potentially say, hey, I'm going to yes. connect with Hemi because mm-hmm. Hemi, you know, she coordinates the Farsi yeah. side, you know, mm-hmm. something like of the, yes. of the sort. Yes. So yes. I can completely see the benefit of something like that.
And, you know, agencies could benefit too. For example, they text me, hey, Hemi, we need somebody. Do you know anybody?
Yeah, exactly.
And it would help them to recruit as well.
So very true. Now, that currently does not exist, I take it, out in Portland, Oregon, or have you created something?
We do have a Society of Interpreters and Translators, which is a wonderful group, and they do have annual conferences, wonderful support system. What I'm talking about is a day-to-day base situation. Mm-hmm. Somebody who would be available by text, by phone, somebody who, hey, you know, I had this situation. For example, I have this ill feeling. Can you just talk to me for a little bit? Mm. Or can you come online, let's Zoom, and just sort out to see if you can come up with a better decision? Because, yes, like I said, we do take webinars and we can improve. But how would you, last time I think when I was speaking with you, at this job, I am missing performance reviews. I like to have a performance, some kind of a grading system so I can see somebody else's perspective, get a feedback.
That's so important. Yes, absolutely. I actually am in the middle of diving into a textbook that just recently came out, and they talk about you know, the performance, the self-evaluation, and the importance of feedback for the interpreter. So yeah, that would be completely interesting to dive into, and probably something that you might even enjoy as well. It's a pretty big book though. Mm-hmm. So yeah, let's get into just a little bit then, Hemi, because you did have experience with so many different types of businesses. And I really like the fact that you said that you brought in those experiences and it just made you a very well-rounded professional interpreter with all the different knowledge that you bring in from all the different sectors that you were able to be a part of. But I think that one of the things that a lot of freelance interpreters, particularly those that are just starting, are always interested in knowing how to get started. And you mentioned something very important in the beginning of your story, which had to do with putting your name out in different places. So if you were to give a brand new interpreter some advice on how to begin as a freelance interpreter, what would be, now that you've done it for so many years, what would be those recommendations that you would give them to help them get started in this profession?
I would say get a friendly coach, somebody who's in the business for quite some time, and they can give you honest feedback and help you. So I'm not saying pay them. You know, there are lots of professions that they can do this voluntary.
Like a mentor.
Mm-hmm. So this person can set goals for you. And first and foremost, you have to like the profession. Just because you speak the language and probably you're very good at it, it doesn't make you a good interpreter or even a translator. Because this profession, like doctors, it comes from heart. You have to feel it. You have to sense it. The doctors feel the pain of the patient. That's why they can diagnose and they understand. And of course, the science behind it. And this profession also has science as well. The science of communication and human relations. So you have to like people.
Yeah. please like people. Yeah, I love that. I was trying to pause there because it was such an important message. I didn't want to interrupt. But I like that. Please like people. I mean, at the very basic.
And yeah, if you put the money before people, then this is not a good route to go. I suggest pick something else.
Yeah, great point. What about in terms of getting your name out with different agencies as opposed to just going to one?
Yes. Once you have the coach, of course, will just show you the path. Sign up with the agencies. They will test you out. And then learn as much as possible. There are lots of free webinars. They can introduce them. And, of course, they can work on their language proficiencies. And signing up with the language agencies is the first step that everybody took. Because we are like, where do I go? How do I start? In a conference last June, somebody approached me. She said, I'm from California. I want to do interpreting. And I said, well, you came to judicial court interpreting. So have you done interpreting? She says, no. Who are you interpreting for? She says, I want to be a judicial court interpreter. So she basically was learning, and she paid for the conference, and she was there to learn. And another conference we had with health interpreters, and another person during lunch was talking and sharing with me that I like to pursue. And because she was local, I was able to introduce her to some people, and I gave the name of and wrote it down the name of the agencies on a napkin that she can call them, research them, go online and put application. Mm-hmm. So that's the first step. But first they have to know themselves. Do I want to do this? There is a driving involved. There is cost involved at the beginning because we don't make money. And I lost lots of money when I started. Mm-hmm. By the time I came to my assignments and came home, I made $5.
Wow.
All day after work. Well, if I work somewhere for 8 hours, I make more than that. So, but because I like the profession, I just put my heart into it and I didn't mind. But now, hopefully I will reap the benefits of it.
Yeah. And you bring up a great point. Actually, if you are starting in the field and you're trying to get your name into these different agencies as an interpreter, you know, be mindful as well as to who you're applying with, because if it's a company that is only requiring you to speak two languages and they say that that's enough, then I would say run the other way. Because it is not enough, and they should be requiring either that you are trained or are providing some training themselves to the interpreters. I would say at the very minimum, at least 40 hours before you begin something, right? But I would say just do your due diligence in finding agencies that are reputable and that, you know, are not going to do something like that, like send you out to a site. And then by the time that you get back, it's like you've only made $5. And then they take like 45 days to pay you your $5. Don't go with those companies.
Well, in this industry, Miraria, it's changed a lot. Mm-hmm. Remember, I said I had a business, a restaurant business. I had an employee who was Armenian, and she was at the time 19 years old. She just came from Armenia, probably from airport, and she realized that I'm doing interpreting. And she says, I can do Armenian and Russian interpreting. I said, go for it. And she hired her. And then one day I asked her, okay, how do you know terminologies from Russian to English? She says, I just show the sports parts of body. That's how they hired at the time. But now you have to be registered. You have to be qualified, certified. So thank God it's changing.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. I feel like the standards and requirements for interpreting agencies, you know, I think have our higher standard. And I think if you're working with a reputable, hopefully you are, agency, you won't experience any of these things. Mm-hmm. But sadly, as is the case with any field, it's not just interpreting. Mm-hmm. You may encounter someone that is calling themselves an agency and are doing things like that. Now, those are the things that they should not be doing. So that's why I'm saying, if that's what you see, that is not a company you want to align yourself with, just so that you can make a quick buck, because mm-hmm. it's very mm-hmm. very likely that you'll end up in a situation that is very uncomfortable. And then, of course, unfair for the person that is expecting a quality trained interpreter to show up. And, you know, that isn't the case, right? So yeah, just be mindful of that. I think all of those are excellent, Hemi, pieces of advice for an individual that is wanting to start. I'd also like to take the opportunity to sort of do a call to action for any listeners out there who are either Farsi speaking or Armenian speaking, or know of someone that would like to connect directly with Hemi, that they go on to the episode notes and make that connection and see if potentially that's something that could occur, beginning maybe with one state or just virtually in the meantime, so that something like that could be in the works. Because I think that everything that you touched on today is super important. Having that network of professionals that are at our reach whenever it is needed, I think is super important. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, we've talked about this situation with the vicarious trauma. We've talked about compassion fatigue in prior episodes as well, in which individuals, because we work in silos for the most part, day in and day out, just don't really think about reaching out to someone. Whereas if we know that that network exists, that we're able to eventually connect with them and lean on them for support. And it doesn't necessarily have to be on the negative. It could also be just on the learning aspect.
Exactly.
I mean, like, what
success
word
stories.
Do I use for, you know, this word, what, you know, I came across this term today and I, you know, I had a hard time with it, right? Or something of the sort. Anything else, Hemi, that you would like to share with this particular audience, you know, as a Farsi interpreter, that you would wish to share that individuals knew?
Well, as a interpreter in whole, my message is interpreting is a profession, one of the professions that once we see each other, there is an affinity, there is a connection. We kind of get each other and we are easily bonded. Why don't we expand this bonding and help each other and become a buttress for somebody else such that they could have better understanding of teamwork? Because we are missing team. My team is my cat. So by having more connection and having the affinity and camaraderie and confidence. So if I'm calling or if you're calling somebody, you know, you trust them. It's not because they want to take away your job. Because we are not in the business of competition. We are in the business of communication. Actually, this is not my words. It's an interview they had with Mikhail Baryshnikov, the dancer, choreographer. He said, dancing is a form of art and we are expressing ourselves. And interpreting is a form of art as well, I think. We are expressing ourselves in words, expressing others in words. It's even harder.
Even harder. Exactly. No, that's a great message. I think that when we look at it through that lens of the work that we're actually for who we're doing our work, as opposed to this scarcity mentality that if I talk to Hemi of the same language, I'm going to lose work. I think our profession is even more richer if we're able to make those connections, right? And network in that way, that we become better, not only as individuals, but as professionals because of how we will be providing our work. Because now we're, you know, we're sharing ideas and we're sharing resources and, you know, we're just becoming, like you said earlier, Hemi, a well-rounded professional. So I thank you very much, Hemi, for the opportunity to be able to share your story and your experiences, and of course, your advice for anyone out there that is interested in making that connection with Hemi. Please go on down to the episode notes and she will have, or rather, I will have the link to how to be able to connect. But share with our listeners, if you will, where they can find out more about you and the work that you do, Hemi.
They can find me on LinkedIn, H. Periani. And I also have email hpriyani@aol.com.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Of course. My pleasure. Have a wonderful summer.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Remember to share it with your colleagues and friends or on social media. And if you share it on social media, remember to tag me. If you're listening to this podcast on Spotify or Apple Podcast, please give it an honest rating. It really helps the show tremendously. Lastly, if you or someone you know has been making a difference in the language professionals community and would like to be a guest on the show, head on over to my website, brandtheinterpreter.com, and fill out a guest form. Till next time. Hey, thanks for sticking around till the very end. If you'd like to connect with me, head on over to the website, brandtheinterpreter.com, and click on the Connect with Me tab. You can also stay connected on social media, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube as Brand the Interpreter, or Mireya Perez on LinkedIn. Till next time.